Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. And this week and next, my guest is Sean Ryan. Now, Sean created my all-time favorite cop show, The Shield. He also created the highly underrated Terriers and was on The Unit. He ran that show with David Mamet. Oh, we have a lot to talk about. Currently, he is the showrunner on SWAT, and he is one of my all-time favorite writers. So I am thrilled that this week and next week, I get a chance to introduce you to Sean Ryan.
Well, I first met you at a SHIELD premiere party, like season three or four, and The Shield is, to this day, it's my favorite all-time cop show. And I came up to meet you, and I was just a geeky fanboy. And I was shocked that you knew who I was because of Cheers. And you said you always wanted to write a Cheers.
Well, in fact, the very first TV script I wrote was a Cheers script. But I grew up, I was born in 1966. And so I came of age in TV when the sitcom was the dominant form of television. You know, I think so many of the shows, including MASH, which obviously you wrote on, and Mary Tyler Moore Show, and All in the Family, and WKRP in Cincinnati. You know, I can just go on and on. All these shows from the 70s and early 80s were so seminal for me that. I of course I knew who you were. And when I started watching Cheers, I think I read a review like in TV Guide back when families would still get TV Guide mailed to their house, and you always looked forward to the day that would arrive in the mailbox. And I was one of those people that would pay attention to like what they said about the new fall shows. And I recall them writing some very nice things about Cheers. And I went out of my way to watch that first episode, and I just thought it was spectacular. And I thought, oh my God, what is this? And this is so good. And I made sure to watch, you know, we didn't have a VCR in our house at that time. So if I missed a Thursday night, it was very disappointing. But I tried like hell not to miss any Thursday nights. And about halfway through the season, I remember myself asking the question, why is this show funnier and better than other shows on TV? And I kind of landed in an epiphany moment on, well, the writing's better. The jokes that they're having the actors say are better. The stories are better constructed. And that's when I started paying attention to the writing credits. Before that, I'd never really paid attention to all those names that would roll past at the beginning of an episode. And I always thought the endings of Cheers episodes, I thought the little sort of boom, the emphasis at the end, you know, they'd always get you with some good joke. And then you'd see the Charles brothers, listed and James Burroughs listed. And I just started paying attention to that. So when Ken Levine comes up and talks to me, I'm very aware of who you are.
So you were like 16 then. Did you always want to be a writer?
No, I, even then I didn't want to be a writer. I just like watching TV. I wanted to be an athlete. That was my focus. I did dabble in theater. So I was certainly exposed to the arts, but you know, I was a hockey goalie through the age of 14 on a travel team. I was a very competitive soccer player. I ended up playing soccer in college. So hockey and soccer are my two sports, but I also was captain of my basketball team in high school. I played competitive tennis. I was on a diving team, on a swim team for a couple of years. I would play racquetball. I would do all sorts of sports, and I was good enough at them that I could kind of fool myself to think there was some sort of future in them. And that future extended to college for soccer, but I was never going to be a pro athlete in any way. So no, it wasn't a dream. I wasn't one of these people who knew from the age of 4 or 5 that I wanted to be a writer. But I was a kid from the age of 4 or 5 who was just fascinated with television, even more so than film. You know, movies weren't always so easy for me to see. And growing up in Illinois, you know, you just get what was ever at the Metroplexes. You know, you weren't getting a wide variety the way you might in New York or Los Angeles. So it was TV that really fascinated me. You'd watch repeats in the afternoons when you got home from school. You'd check out the new fall schedule when it came on. And then that morphed when I was in college, which is when I started writing plays. And that's when it became a bit of a dream. And when I said I wrote my first cheer script, that was for a class that I had. I went to Middlebury College, which has a 4-1-4 program, meaning that you have a semester of classes. And then every January term, you just take one class for 3.5 weeks. And it's usually a little bit more of an offbeat class rather than a, you know, hard academic class. And there was an alum of Middlebury's, a guy by the name of Paul Vaughn. Do you remember who Paul?
Yeah, I don't know. Paul Vaughn was one of the guys who sat at the bar.
That's right. And he was actually from Boston, which he claimed was one of the reasons why he got hired. He lent a little Boston authenticity to the cast. He was an alum of Middlebury, and he came to teach a television writing class. And so I didn't even have to think about it. I was like, oh, I'm going to write a cheer script. And Paul came and taught the class. And I just couldn't believe that I was in the same room with somebody who was like occasionally on the show. And I just asked him all sorts of questions about what it was like, you know, what the set was like, how the show ran. And then I wrote a cheer spec script that he was very complimentary about. I'd written my first play by this point, so this was the second script of anything I'd ever written, and he was very encouraging, and that's when I thought, oh, well, you know, maybe I could do this. I ended up changing my major, quitting the soccer team, and focusing on theater and playwriting and TV writing at that point.
You know, I became a writer because I wasn't a good athlete. It's like the only way to get women was to be funny and to be a comedy writer. You know, a number of those bar patrons wrote spec scripts for Cheers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And
no, because the focus of the show was always on them. Okay.
They didn't focus on Sam or Diane or
Rebecca. Yeah, Alan had more lines than Sam. Yeah.
Well, that's something I've learned on my various shows. And listen, I'm married to an actress, and so I can appreciate it. You know, all actors, no matter how big or small the roles, you know, really tend to look at that universe from their character's perspective. And I love it that the actors can see how, you know, their role fits into the universe. But they may have been better off from a writing perspective, giving Sam a little more focus than their character.
Did you ever send the cheer spec anywhere? Did it get any traction?
No, I didn't send anywhere. And then actually I wrote, when I moved out here to Los Angeles and started writing specs, I won a comedy playwriting award for best comedy play in the country through the American College Theater Festival. Best comedy in, you know, of a college produced play by a college student.
Is that the Norman Lear Prize that you won?
Yes, it used to be called the Norman Lear. By the time I had won it, they had changed the title to the very unwieldy Columbia Pictures Television Comedy Playwriting Award or something like that. And I learned who some of the previous winners were. And I learned that one of the winners was this guy by the name of Fief Sutton, who of course I recognized from the Cheers credits along with everyone else. And when I first moved out here in 1990, I mustered up the courage and somehow got an office number for Fief Sutton and left a message saying, "Hey, I'm the latest winner of this award. I heard that you are a previous winner. If there's any way we could have a phone call and I could just ask you some questions, you know, I would be so appreciative." And he contacted me back, and we ended up having a phone call. And he was the very first professional TV writer I ever spoke to along the way. And he was extraordinarily nice, considering.
Yeah, he is extraordinary. Considering
he was
nice.
Busy making that show and writing on that show, and he took probably 45 minutes to talk with me. And then cut to years later, he came and worked with us and wrote with us on Terriers, you know, that had you know, a lot of comedic elements. And so that came full circle. I was able to hire a Cheers writer at some point to work with me.
So when you came out here, you originally wanted to be a sitcom writer.
Well, I thought that's what I was supposed to be. When you win a Comedy Playwright Award, and part of the award is to spend 2 weeks in the writer's room of a network sitcom, in this case, NBC's My Two Dads. I thought I was supposed to be a sitcom writer. They had a staff of like 7 or 8 people who I met. One of the writers on that staff was Chuck Lorre. So Chuck was one of the very first people I met in Los Angeles.
Okay, I've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah, because I moved out here on December 31st, 1989. So I spent one day of the 80s in Los Angeles. I'd never been to Los Angeles before. And then I think you can go back and look at the calendar. Whatever that first Monday was, it was either January 2nd or January 3rd. That's when my 2 weeks in the writer's room started. And I got to see a couple of episodes. And I got to see them write. And I got to go down to set and see the rehearsals. And I got to see the tape nights. And everything. And so, yeah, I thought I was supposed to be, and I ended up selling a story to them. Bob Meyer was the showrunner at that point. And when my 2 weeks were up, I knew that they were kind of shy a couple of stories for the rest of the season. I said, "Hey, would it be possible for me to come in and pitch you some ideas?" And once again, you know, somebody was just extraordinarily nice beyond the point that they needed to be. And he said, "Sure." And I came in a couple weeks later and I pitched a few ideas. And the ideas that I had worked out in great detail, he rightfully rejected. And I was sort of at the end, I was about to say, "Well, thanks for giving me the chance." I said, "Well, I have this one idea. I haven't really had time to flesh it out. I just pitched this one-liner idea." And he was like, "Well, that's interesting." He spent about 5 minutes talking about, "Well, we could do this." And I realized by the end that I'd sold this idea that really he had come up with based on this one-liner I had said. So my very first TV credit is a story by credit that he had a couple of the staff writers on the show.
I was going to say, they didn't let you write it? Award-winning writer?
Well, yeah. No, listen, I totally understood what happened. And it was such a, I could point to so many moments that were moments of good fortune for me in my career. They were doing this whole storyline where, you know, the two leads of that show were Paul Reiser and Greg Evigan. And they had a storyline where there was going to be a love interest introduced. I think it was for the Paul Reiser character. And that was it was going to be a recurring role for like 3 or 4 episodes. And they were having difficulty casting it. And so all of a sudden they were like, "Well, we're supposed to film this episode in a week and a half, but we still don't have the woman we want." Bob bought this idea and was like, "I'm just going to hand this to some of our writers because we need to film this like in 10 days. So literally they were filming the episode with the one-liner I had pitched like 10 days after I pitched it. So there was no time to give me any chance to, you know, I was a rank amateur at that point. But they allowed me to come back. All of a sudden there was a parking spot on the Sunset Gower lot with my name stenciled on it for about 2 additional weeks. And they let me come to the rehearsals for that and watch the tape night. And so that was pretty extraordinary. So when that happened, I thought, yeah, I'm supposed to be a comedy writer. And I was writing off comedy scripts. And what I ultimately found out was, I think I could have been an upper level comedy writer. Cause I had a good sense of comedy story, but I just wasn't a hard joke writer. And what I realized was that's what they wanted in their lower level writers. They wanted people who could just be, you know, funny on command, who could come up with the hard jokes. And so I couldn't really get my foot in the door, and I couldn't get that first staff job because I think my scripts, and I guess me in real life, you know, was humorous, but just not hard funny enough at that time. And then I also realized that a lot of the TV I was watching were dramas. You know, I was watching L.A. Law. Twin Peaks came out the first year I was in Los Angeles and really had a big effect. And so I started writing drama specs along with comedy specs and almost went on this dual track of, okay, I'm trying to be a comedy writer, but I'm also trying to be a drama writer. And then I ultimately got my first staff job on a drama, and I got hired off a comedy spec, a Larry Sanders show.
Is that right?
I had written. So
what was that, Nash Bridges? Was that your first?
Nash Bridges was my first staff job. Yeah, and that was a cop show, but it had a lot of comedic B stories and side elements to it. So they valued people that could sort of do the drama and the comedy. So they read two scripts of mine, a Larry Sanders show, and then also at NYPD Blue. But I think it was the Larry Sanders one that they really liked. And so I'm glad I did give up on the comedy because the comedy script eventually landed me in a drama writer's room and sort of set me off on that path for my career.
Then you did Angel.
Yeah, I did 3 years of Nash Bridges, and I wrote or co-wrote 11 episodes of the show. And there was a real formula to that show that I wouldn't say I got bored because it was always exciting to actually be working on a TV show. But I certainly felt myself constrained as a writer, and they wanted me to come back for what turned out to be the final season, the sixth season of the show. It would have been my fourth season, but I got an offer to go on Angel, and I thought, well, it's less security here. And they don't know me and like me the way that Carlton Cuse and John Worth like me at Nash, and it's less money, but it feels like an opportunity to learn something that I haven't learned at Nash. And so I kind of took a leap and I jumped onto Angel. Now, between those things, right near the end of Nash going into Angel, I'd been hired to write a sitcom pilot by Fox TV Studios. And eventually that deal became the Shield pilot. I did not write a sitcom for them. I wrote the Shield pilot instead. And so yeah, I did Angel, but during my 1 year run at Angel, the Shield script was kind of getting out there in the world, and drew the attention of FX, and I learned that they wanted to make a pilot. So I only ended up working for 1 year on Angel. But it was a great year. It was a little out of my comfort zone, which turned out to be a good thing, because it made me stretch as a writer. And then when the Shield did get picked up, I had two examples to draw from. I had, you know, 3 years at Nash Bridges and a year at Angel, because Joss Whedon, David Greenwalt, and Tim Minear ran things very differently on Angel than I was used to at Nash Bridges. And so it gave me a variety of perspective that I could draw from when I eventually went off to make the Shield.
Let's talk about the Shield. Yep. What was the inspiration for that show? And it seems like you did an awful lot of research, because it seemed to be the most authentic police show I've ever seen.
Oh, well, you're very kind. Thank you. I'd always loved other cop shows. So there were a few inspirations. One is that I'd been a huge fan of Homicide: Life on the Street. And by this point, the show was either at the end or had ended. I'd been a big fan of NYPD Blue, but David Milch had left the show, and I think some of the magic had left the show at that point. I had been a big fan of Law and Order, but that was a formula show, and by that point, you know, we were 8, 9, 10 years into the formula. And I realized that there was no, for the first time in a long time, there was no cop show that I was looking forward to each week that I had to watch. And I thought, well, maybe I should write the show that I feel like I need to watch each week. And so so that was one inspiration, was just like looking at the landscape and saying, hey, I want to watch a cop show that's different that I love and I don't see one on TV. So why don't I try to write one? You could call it research. I just mostly call it reading. I was just always reading. I was reading nonfiction books about law enforcement and serial killers and everything. I would always read, back when we actually would get physical newspapers dropped off at our doors in the mornings, I would read the LA Times every day and read stuff. And the Rampart scandal had broken, and there were this constant avalanche of articles as more and more information came out that I was always reading. And then the other inspiration was an incident that happened for Nash Bridges, which was a show that filmed in San Francisco. They sent us up there to do some police ride-alongs in San Francisco. And it took me about 15 minutes on my very first police ride-along to realize, oh, there's going to be nothing from this we can use for Nash Bridges. Like this is real. This is harrowing. This is, you know, feels inherently dangerous. You know, Nash never felt dangerous. You always knew that Don Johnson was going to end up fine at the end of the episode. You always knew that the bad guys were going to get caught.
Oh, there was, this is a spoiler alert.
There was a cynicism that I noticed in real life that felt protective. Like, these people have to be cynical because the things they see are so difficult. That I thought, well, I don't really see that level of cynicism on TV. So that was interesting. So it was a combination of all these things. And then I would say that, you know, I talked about my sports background. Another thing that I felt I didn't see a lot of was what I call locker room culture. You know, I'd spent my entire life until my early 20s in locker rooms around other alpha. Well, I don't want to describe myself as an alpha male, but when you play sports, you play sports at high level, you're around a lot of alpha males. You're around a lot of testosterone. You're around a lot of, you know, joking and jockeying around and everything. And I felt like I hadn't seen much of that on TV. What I felt was true locker room. So another inspiration, especially for the strike team, especially for a lot of those scenes and content that took place.
Yeah, you had them playing poker and joking around a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, where they play softball and, you know, get into fights on the softball field and everything. You know, I was still playing hockey recreationally and while I was making the shield. And there'd be times where, you know, I'd be writing the shield and then I'd go on a Tuesday night and play a game at 10:30 and, you know, maybe not get into a full fledged fight on the ice rink, but, you know, close to a fight. and then you'd, you know, be undressing in the locker room afterwards, the other guys talking about, oh, that fucker did this and blah, 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 you know? And so that was another inspiration, was just trying to bring, some might call it a toxic masculine aspect that wasn't really investigated on TV. So that was a case where my athletic background, I think, came in handy. That's another reason I love Cheer so much. I love that he was an ex-ball player and that he was like a good ball player, but maybe not a great one. He wasn't like a Hall of Famer, but he sort of lived off that fame. And I always felt like there were early episodes in Cheers when, like, Fred Dreyer's character, the sportscaster, came on, where I felt that got athlete culture right. I really admired that about the show early on.
Hard to believe, considering who wrote it.
Well, certainly with your background, you knew a lot about baseball.
Well, you know, you write about serial killers, and chances are you're not one. Your lead character, I guess, too, the timing, it was really the era of the anti-hero, because what your lead character, Vic Mackey, does at the end of the pilot is absolutely shocking. How did that test?
There was some... Listen, I know the FX tested the pilot, and they shared some details of the pilot with me, of the testing of the pilot, but they didn't, like, share the full report. I was told that the pilot tested okay to good, but not great. But they felt like the show was so different that it would be difficult for it to test great.
Good for them.
Because the main character does shoot someone in the face at the end of the pilot episode. So they knew that that... but what they were looking for at that time, and we see it very prevalent now, they weren't looking for that show to be 50% of a show that 50% of America occasionally tuned into. They wanted it to be the show that 3 to 5% of America thought it was their absolute favorite show and would make every effort in the world to see it and would evangelize it to their friends. You know, and this was sort of the beginning, I would say, of the niche programming thing that, you know, when you came up, you know, writing the MASHes and the Cheerses of the world, there were three networks, and it was all about getting at least a 35 share, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about making sure that, you know, you weren't third place in a 3-horse race. And you had to, and you couldn't offend too many people doing that. So it's kind of remarkable what a show like MASH and a show like Cheers were able to do in terms of the content they were to do, and yet still appeal to such wide audiences. But for us, we were able to say, hey, you know, most cops out there are good, but there are some out there that are doing shit like this. And here's what that life looks like. And there were people that were offended by that notion who would never watch the show based on what the content was. And FX was cool with that, because there were people that when they watched it, they felt like they couldn't see this anywhere else, and they couldn't see a show like that anywhere else. And so I was very fortunate to have that script ready to hand out, right, when FX was ready to make that kind of programming. And I also have to just give a nod. It seems obvious, but it's just important to give credit and honor to The Sopranos, because I never would have written the Shield script if The Sopranos didn't exist, because I don't know that I would have that I would have thought a show like The Shield would be possible if I hadn't seen the success that The Sopranos had.
And you were on FX, probably the first or one of the first made for basic cable series.
It was the second. There was a show called Son of the Beach, which was a comedy that Howard Stern produced. That was kind of a, it was kind of a mockumentary style thing of like Baywatch. You know, it was a satire of a sort of Baywatch era show, and that's why Howard Stern never liked The Shield, because FX canceled Son of the Beach to change what it wanted to do with its original programming, which was go darker and more awards baity and everything. But yeah, so FX at that point had Son of the Beach on, and then had like Beverly Hills Now 2-1-0 repeats and Buffy the Vampire Slayer repeats during the day.
Right. And MASH. Lots of MASH.
Yeah, lots of things that 20th had produced. Because they were taking from the 20th Century Fox 20th Television library for a lot of their stuff. And I remember when I first got a call that, like, hey, that script you wrote, it was called The Barn back then. There's some people interested in The Barn. They want to talk to you, people at FX. And I was like, do you mean Fox? No, not Fox, FX. And I didn't know what FX was when I was told that. And I had to go, oh, that's one of these cable channels. Like, well, what's on that? And I was like, they're going to do, or they're going to talk about doing this show? This is nuts. But I didn't know. But Peter Liguori and Kevin Riley, with the blessing of Peter Chernin, were ready to kind of change what basic cable could be. And I was, you know, very fortunate. Again, I can point to a very fortunate series of events that led to my career. They were ready to do the kind of show that I had just written.
Let's talk about the casting. When you wrote the pilot, did you have a specific actor in mind?
Well, first I have to realize when I wrote the pilot, I never thought anyone would make it. I thought, well, this is just a script I'm going to get paid to write, and it will become my next sample, will become my next spec script that I can use if I get fired off Angel, you know, or, at that point. I didn't think, I tend not to write with people in mind. The only thing I thought at the time was, oh, this is like a Harrison Ford character. In my mind, I was like, okay. This is sort of a dirty, nasty Harrison Ford, was what I thought of it. I thought it would be somebody with, you know, charisma that gives you, you know, that smile and you can't help but like him, but then he's doing these things that aren't necessarily likable. And so I really learned an important lesson about casting when we were casting the S.H.I.E.L.D. pilot. Because I did have that specific, like, Harrison Ford thing in my mind. This has to be a TV classically good-looking guy, you know, with the hair and everything. You know, as a bald guy, you know, I'm so jealous of people with hair. I'm looking at your hair right now and going, you know, how have you managed the hair this whole time? You know, I was losing mine in my, you know, mid to late 20s. So I had
writing this comedy.
Yeah, we're tearing our hair out on the dramas. But I was thinking, okay, it's got to be this. And then as we were seeing people that kind of match that physicality, they weren't really the actors that made that role sing in the audition process. And again, another twist of good fortune for me, my wife Kathy had been childhood friends with Michelle Chiklis. They had grown up in the same neighborhood of North Miami Beach, Florida, with Michelle. And then Michelle ultimately married Michael. So occasionally, Kathy and I would run into Michael and Michelle just about town. And in one case, somewhat famously in the S.H.I.E.L.D. retelling, at a gymboree class when we both had young kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was aware of Michael from that. I had never really watched The Commish, but I was aware of him as an actor. And so we were seeing people audition for Vic Mackey, and I wasn't seeing anyone that was even remotely right. And Deb Aquila, our casting director on the pilot, called. And the other thing is nobody wanted to audition for an FX show.
Yeah, I get that too.
This is, you know, FX doesn't make TV. We may like the script, but there's no way it's going to translate into a good show.
One's going to see it. Yeah.
No one's going to see it. So the major agencies wouldn't even let their, wouldn't submit their clients, wouldn't send the clients in for auditions. It was really hard. And so Deb Aquila called and we were talking various casting things. And then she said, Michael Chiklis's people called. He wants to come in and read. But he's not what you've described. And I think he's wrong. And so I think we should pass. And I said, yeah, he doesn't really seem right. I go, but like my wife is friends with his wife and occasionally we run into him. And
so many
other people aren't auditioning. It kind of feels rude, like not to let him audition. So if he wants to read, why don't we let him read? When I had met him, he had been heavier. He was sort of in that commish body thing. What I didn't know was during the period that I'd seen him, he'd really kind of worked out. He lost weight. He really became quite chiseled. He, you know, almost had this like Bruce Willis thing. And so when he walked in the door for that audition, he looked different than I remembered. He had the shaved head now. And then he gave just the world's greatest audition. And I realized, oh, what I've been thinking of the role is not what the role is. This is the role. And I needed an actor to really embody it, to educate me. Another example of that, where I really learned to have an open mind about casting, was Claudette Wims, who was played by CCH Pounder. She had done a TV movie for HBO that Clark Johnson had directed, and Clark was our director on The Shield pilot. She really enjoyed working with Clark, and so her manager realized, oh, Clark's directing this new pilot, let me read it. And she reads the script, and she realizes that there is no good role for Cece in it, but she calls up our casting people and says, hey, this role of Charles, who's a man, why can't that be a woman, and why can't Cece play it? And that message gets passed on to me, and I go, well, there is no reason why that couldn't be a woman, I guess. What? Let's have her come in and read. And she was okay in her first reading, but she kind of apologized. I didn't get it right. Could I come back a second time? And she came back a second time, and she was just amazing. And I realized, oh, this role is supposed to be a woman. But I didn't realize that until I saw the right woman come in and be it. And so that was a lesson I learned very early on, is that if you get too specific about what you think the casting should be for a role, you are closing yourself off to what could be much better possibilities.
And the good casting directors will oftentimes bring you people and say, okay, I know this isn't exactly what you're looking for, but there's something very interesting about this actor.
That's right.
And it's worth 5 minutes of your time. And you go, yeah, this is lightning in a bottle. I'll rewrite for this actor. No, we once had a situation in casting where my partner and I would try to think of specific actors so that we were both on the same page when we were writing these pilots. There was a specific actor we thought of for this role. And the actor came in and read. And the actor read it exactly the way we heard it in our head. And when he walked out, both David and I looked at each other and said, I think we can do better.
My friend Dave Snell, who played Ronnie, like I said, he was in Kansas. He was based out of Kansas City for a while before he came to LA. And he told me once, he worked a lot there, and he got a breakdown once that they were looking for a David Reese Snell type, but they didn't call him. And I always thought, oh, the joy of being an actor, this archetype, but won't have ultimately get cast in the role.
Well, casting is such an important part of the process, because I say it's the only thing you can't fix.
Yeah. Well, the directing can screw you up too, but yes, the casting is Well, to give you an example of that, I just told the story about Michael coming in and auditioning. What I didn't say is that a day or two before that, after we had seen like the 30th bad Vic Mackey audition, when the actor left the room, I turned to Clark Johnson, our director, and I said, you know, maybe this script isn't as good as I think it is, because, you know, as I'm hearing the words, it's not like playing that well. And maybe what I need to do is like rewrite a lot of this. Maybe the problem is the writing. And then a day or two later, Michael comes in, he auditions and does the whole thing, and he leaves the room, and there's like a 5-second pause. And then I turned to Clark and said, no, I'm a great writer. This is a great script.
No, it's true. Because when you've heard your material mangled by 30 different people.
In different ways.
You're going, wait, I don't even understand the logic of that choice. And these are all, you know, established SAG actors. Isn't community theater. And you're looking at them and, plus, you know, for us, there's the added element of not funny. Good actor. Okay. Great look. Not funny.
Like, I'm always amazed. Like, I watched a documentary once on the making of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And famously, CBS didn't want any of those actors other than Mary in the show. And they found these actors. Ed Asner was known for drama, not for comedy. Ted Knight wasn't known for comedy then. Gavin
McLeod.
Yeah, wasn't known. And then I think of like Leslie Nielsen's, you know, coming to fame in the Airplane movies and everything. How could you figure out who the serious actors who could do comedy? Is it just by hearing them or are they just, you know, when you go for the people known for comedy, or would you try to explore, is there somebody that's great at comedy and we just don't know it yet?
It's hearing it. And I also find that dramatic actors who play really interesting villains tend to be very good at comedy. I remember seeing RoboCop for the first time and seeing Kurtwood Smith.
Yeah.
And going, I got to work with that guy. That guy is great. And ultimately we brought him in for a pilot, which got on the air, and he was extremely funny.
Yeah.
And people didn't think that. We had David Morse in our pilot. We take him to the network and he had a great reading. And the network president was like, God, I don't know. He's a dramatic actor, you know, he did Saint Elsewhere. And one of the other executives say, I don't understand. We all laughed, didn't we?
Yeah, sometimes it's just that simple. I was always excited when I could find a comedic actor that we could give a dramatic opportunity to. Like on The Shield, I think of Anthony Anderson, who had done like Kangaroo Jack and done these sort of comedies. But when we were coming up with the Antoine character for season 4, his name got brought up and I had a meeting with him, and he really fought for that role. And he was like, listen, you know, I'm known for these goofy comedy stuff, but like, I'm a guy who grew up in South Central. Like I get this world and I get this sort of thing. And we worked with him, and FX was unsure, and FX made us like read him and reread him. And I think a total of 3 times before they finally agreed. And then he was just so great on that show. And I think comedic actors can transition to drama better than a lot of drama actors can transition to comedy, I think.
It's probably true. I think it's very interesting when you can cast against type. I mean, to me, just a primary example of that is Margot Martindale in right. Justified.
Right.
She was just such a wonderful villain. Well, you guys had some great casting. It's interesting when you look at supporting characters of shows, you never know what's going to happen down the line. You know, she could become the Princess of England, you know, or he could murder his wife and spend 40 years in prison. And that's what you had with Michael Chase.
Yeah, no, very tragic.
Were you completely shocked?
Sure. How could you not be shocked? I remember just being at home late one night, and I was checking Twitter, and somebody in my mentions said something about Michael Chase and killed his wife, and I was like, what is he talking about? And I started searching, and ultimately the news came out that he had shot and killed his wife. And you work with an actor for 7 years, and by this point, I forget what year this happened, so I don't know how many years had passed since the end of the show. You know, Michael was an intense guy. I never fully felt like I completely understood him. But I'd never expected anything like that. I never had an indication that he would be, you know, violent towards someone. And it's very strange when you spend years writing about crimes and crimes of passion and these sorts of things, And then somebody that spent a lot of time with did this. And I had spoken to him maybe 3, 4, 5 months before that had happened. He had been working on a script and was interested in my thoughts and, you know, that he had written with someone, and I read it and I got on the phone with the two of them. And it was just, you know, like I'm sure you do when you're mentoring people, you know, people have written something and they're interested in your opinion. And we had a nice conversation and, you know, and it turns out that, you know, things were going hard for him and his marriage was dissolving and you know, I still don't fully understand the circumstances of that night and what led to it. But he lost control and made a tragic mistake that took a mother away from his two sons. I haven't spoken to him since the incident. It's weird to think, you know, he's in a real prison the way that, you know, our show portrayed other people going to prison. So it is a weird aspect when I go back and watch Shield episodes and sort of say, well, is there something I missed? Is there something I should have known? I feel for his two sons, you know, who lost both their parents in different ways, you know, yeah, because of one horrible night.
And I think of all of the actors, the shows that I've worked on, and I'm thinking, who could have done that among the actors that I've worked with? And I can't think of any, but then I think of the writers that I've worked with. And then I can get like 7.
So that's part one with Sean Ryan. Come back next week when we'll be talking about series finales, working with David Mamet, also Terriers, which was a fabulous show that never got its due, the art of show running, network politics, and a lot more. That is next week with Sean Ryan. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. If you want to get in touch with me for any reason, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That is my email address. You can follow me on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine, and check out my New Yorker cartoons. So come back next week, part 2 with Sean Ryan, right here on
Hollywood and Levine.